The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, November 9th, 2007. This is episode number 103. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here this week to talk about MotoGP as I am every week. We got some good stuff lined up. We got a chat with Jules, doing a Valencia GP wrap-up and talking extensively about the 125cc race at Valencia. We haven't been talking much about the support classes this year, but there's been some really good racing, and that race at Valencia was no exception, so that's a cool call. Then we got Chuck Axlin, manager of Team KR. He's on the phone. He's nice enough to take a call and spend some time with us on the phone. Always interesting stuff. A little bit of a disjointed editing thing that I got going on with there, but it came out pretty good. Chuck's full of great insight, and talk a little bit about their season and the thing they did with the names on the bike and all sorts of good stuff there. And let's see what else we got is some news, a little bit of reader email, and all kinds of other stuff. So without any further ado, why don't we talk first of all about I got sent several links to videos from reader email, which is very nice. Thanks, guys. The first one of those was from JJ Dewar, longtime MotoGPOD listener, and he sent me a link about breaking news video from CNN.com. It's a great video about Ducati and Casey Stoner from CNN. It's pretty much kind of like a Ducati factory tour with the obligatory sort of trendy chick news journalist. And it's really pretty cool. It's on CNN International. It's on their website, though. I'm going to put up a link. It's way, way too long to just say. But if you go to CNN.com and search for Ducati, you'll probably find it. Or the easier way is going to be go to the MotoGPOD website and click on the link that I will put up there. It's good stuff, like I said, real interesting, and you got a little bit of Casey Stoner going on, so it's a nice tie-in with MotoGP, and it somewhat also illustrates, I think, some of the Ducati-ness, you know, the whole thing about why people get so wrapped up in their Ducatis, which, you know, I like Ducatis. I think they're nice and everything. I personally have not been bitten by the Ducati bug, but then I don't have one. So I suppose if I had one, I may well be bitten by the Ducati bug. Although somewhat the sound, everybody goes on about the sound of Ducatis. I always think they sound like a big bag full of wrenches being rattled around, but that's just me. Then I got another email from listener Sean George in the UK, and he just said, hey, are you able to get this video in the US? And there was a link to BBC.com UK, BBC.co UK website. And unfortunately, I have not yet been able to view this video. I had some difficulties with it at work, like a broken link sort of a thing or a plugin canceled. Not sure what's going on. So I figured, oh, I'll just do it from home. Got home, realized why I don't have the Real Player plugin installed on my laptop. And I frankly did not have time to go through the whole rigmarole of installing all of that stuff. So I'm going to hold off on it and I'll watch the video later. But it sounds great. It's an interview with the delectable, if aged, Susie Perry talking to Valentino Rossi. And Valentino Rossi talks to Susie Perry about his frustrations after a disappointing year and his hopes to be back challenging for the title next season. So I thought it sounded worth a listen, and hopefully that link is not broken permanently because I am going to put it on the website, and I hope that you guys can get a chance to see that video. And the other video link that I have is actually on the Kropotkin Thinks blog at MotoGPMatters.com. And that's David Emmett's blog called Kropotkin Thinks. It's an excellent blog. If you don't sort of regularly check out that site, I encourage you to do so, MotoGPMatters.com. And he was sent an interesting little trailer for the MTV reality show that is coming out. There was some speculation, you know, we'd heard about it, like as far ago as last February, that they're going to be doing this reality show with Nikki Hayden. As recently as just a couple of weeks ago, I had people asking me, hey, do you know anything about it? I could not find anything on the internet about when this show was going to be airing. It's going to start next Friday, which is November 16th. And they say the time is at 10 p.m. So I don't know if that's 10 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Pacific. You know, I don't know how MTV does their stuff. I'm going to have to look into that myself. So check your local listings and all that good stuff. And unfortunately, it sounds like it's only available in the United States. So if you're international, you need to call your cable or satellite supplier or whatever and telling me you want this thing. But it's an 8-part miniserie about Nicky Hayden and his defending of the championship from 2007. Starts off with him winning the championship 2006 and goes on from there. I have a press release here that Terry James was kind enough to send to me, and we'll do a couple of excerpts from this. MTV takes fans along for a ride with the Kentucky Kid on Friday, November 16th at 10 p.m. Eastern or Pacific. There we go. That answers that question. So it looks like, assuming you have a normal MTV feed, it's going to be at 10 o'clock. Professional motorcycle racer Nicky Hayden gives viewers an inside look into the world of professional motorcycle racing with a 2-hour movie special. At speeds of over 200 miles an hour, pro motorcycle racer Nicky Hayden wins his first ever MotoGP World Championship, a year ago, and defends his title as MTV puts viewers in the fast lane with a 2-hour movie special, Kentucky Kid, blah, blah, blah. And it does sound like fun. I hope that it's going to be good stuff. One thing I'm a little bit nervous about, this is produced by the same people that brought you Ozzy's, you know, the Osbournes television show and some of these other sort of, well, craptacular MTV type reality sort of haha shows. And, well, but it doesn't, just looking at the trailer, I think this is going to be more. This is going to be better. And also, I'm hoping that Nicky Hayden is not going to be so much of a part of something that's, you know, well, crap. And he actually has a credit as a producer, so it should be good stuff. Okay, so that covers the videos that we got links about. Now let's talk a little bit real quick about an email that I got from listener Lee Lipinski, who lives in Vegas. And I met Lee in person down there at Laguna Seca this year, 2007. Nice guy. We had a little chat and everything, got to talk to each other and meet each other face-to-face. It was good stuff. And he mentioned he'd live in Vegas, but I didn't know the full details of what he does in Vegas. And longtime listeners might know that I'm a big fan of the game of craps and that I, you know, go to Vegas every year for work, not just specifically to go to play craps. But when I do this trade show in Vegas, I always make time to spend down there at the craps table. There's nothing like a $50 beer that you is supposedly free. But in any event, Lee says that he's a dealer and craps, which is, by the way, the hardest game for those guys to work. If you've ever seen dealers in the craps game working, it's they're busy, and it takes four people to run a craps table. So it's a complicated game. There's a lot going on, and it's good stuff. But to get to the meat of what I'm going on about, rattling on and on, Lee says, when I'm on a craps game, I often call out the numbers and add the writers' names. He says players and dealers will sometimes call out, you know, Michael Jordan for a 3-2, meaning one die is 3 and one die is 2. So it's a 5, but you say 3-2 is 5. And they'll call out Michael Jordan for a 3-2 or Barry Sanders for whatever number he is. And Lee, you don't know what his number is. I don't even know who he is, so don't feel bad. So Lee calls out a 4-6 Valentino Rossi or a 3-3 Marco Melandri and so on, but he has not yet met a single person who acts like they have a clue what he's talking about. Mentioning MotoGP at all is met with blank stares. However, anytime there's an Aussie on the game, he asks, how about that Casey Stoner? And they almost always have at least heard the name. So hats off to the folks down under. I just thought that was kind of interesting and a telling thing. And for one, good on you, Lee, for promoting MotoGP at your craps table. I think that's really neat, and I think it's a great idea. So anybody else who's a craps fanatic like myself might want to bear that in mind next time you roll a 10 that's a 4-6, you know, shout out, yeah, 4-6, Valentino Rossi, or something like that. But I thought it was kind of fun. And it's also the sad state of affairs that, you know, all these people flooding through the casino and nobody's ever heard of some of these writers and all of that. And it's like, you people in the United States, you need to get a life, start watching a good sport. And let's see, one last little thing to read here. This is kind of important stuff. They finally announced the full-on amendments to the MotoGP tire regulations. This was from November 3rd, so it's a little while ago, but it's still newsworthy, and I want to read you the full details here, more or less. Basically, in a nutshell, the allocation, they're still going to have the allocation of tires. However, it is going to go up. It's going to go up from 31 to 40. And they're also going to change some of the testing rules. They're going to allow the tire manufacturers to test at one pre-nominated MotoGP venue for 4 days per year, in addition to the official test days throughout the season. Yada, yada, yada. Now, here, when do they pick those tires, though? That is going to be the question. Teams that are supplied by a tire manufacturer that achieved at least two MotoGP wins since the first race, blah, blah, blah. During all practice sessions, warm up in the race, a maximum of 40 slick tires. However, it doesn't say anything about when they have to pick them. That's interesting. So I probably should have researched that one a little better. Oh, well. In any event, at least they changed the tire rule somewhat, and I will find out the details on when they have to make those tire choices, and I'll let you know, because as you guys know, tires are very important to me. I like tires a lot, and I think that we need to continue developing those tires as much as possible. So I think that's enough for our intro stuff. We pretty much covered all of these things that we need to talk about. Oh, one last thing. Don't forget, Laguna Seca tickets went on sale this past week at lagunaseca.com, laguna-seca.com. So make sure you get your tickets for the Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix at Laguna Seca. It'll be interesting to see if attendance suffers at all from the fact that there's now a second U.S. round with the Indianapolis race, or how well it goes. I noticed some of the prices went up a little bit. Paddock passes are up to $50. I believe they were only $40 last year, if I recall correctly. It's still well worth it. You got to get a paddock pass if you're going. But you can get those tickets, laguna-seca.com. If you want to do the full-on deal where you're treated like royalty and get free food and free booze and, most importantly, an air-conditioned seat, check out Steve Jones's sweet deals that he's got going on at the usmotogpfans.com website. He's got some great situations going on there where you get you're buying a seat basically in a really fancy box and where you air conditioned luxury right there on the front straight. You've got a TV sitting right there that you can watch, so you see the back sections of the track, and there's all kinds of great stuff included and everything. Full details at usmotogpfans.com. And if you do go up there and you end up purchasing a ticket, just tell them that Bob from MotoGPOD sent you. So, all right, let's get on with the rest of the show. Okay, we got Jules on the phone. How you doing today, Jules?
Bob, good morning. How are you?
Good. Good morning to you, too, as well. So we wrapped up our season. We had the race in Valencia, which was kind of a mixed bag. Super good 1-2-5 race that you turned me on to. So why don't we talk about that a little bit? Let's see. As we know, going into the MotoGP class, going into Valencia, the championship was decided and everything. It was a little bit of a lame duck race, but we were looking forward to a good race, and I think we got it. I enjoyed it. It was a good race.
There was the big battle for the second spot and a big battle for the fourth spot.
Exactly. So much like several of the other races through the year, first is somewhat decided, but you've got some real good action going on a little farther down the order. And it was a bit of a surprise, too, because it wasn't a Casey Stoner runaway. So
that's right.
That makes for a change. But details on everything. Let's see. Want to run down the grid real quick, super quick. Pedrosa, Stoner, Hayden on the front row. Sort of some good stuff there. DePugnier, Quintoli, and Tomata on the second row. Which interesting to see the two Dunlops up there on the second row. I thought that was kind of cool. And then third row, Hopkins, Caparossi, and Cheka. Fourth row, Melandri, Vermeulen, and Barros, doing his last appearance along with Cheka. Fifth row, Nakano, Elias, and Colin Edwards in 15th. And sixth row, Ant West, Valentino Rossi. We'll talk about that in just a second. And Curtis Roberts. And then 19th on the grid was Chaz Davis. So, Valentino Rossi, first of all, big crash on Saturday. Broke his hand. Did you ever see the video or any of that stuff?
I have not seen any video of it.
Yeah, myself either. I heard it was pretty gnarly, but obviously it was because he broke his hand. It was his right hand. It looked like his index finger and maybe I'm misremembering. It was two fingers that were that were messed up, and I guess he broke the metacarpals in there.
There were three bones that were fractured, and of course it's his throttle and braking hand again. So very, very bad for a rider.
Exactly. And judging from that, just the stresses that these guys go under braking, no matter which hand you've got broken, it doesn't sound like much fun. You know, you're basically being propelled forward into those bars under deceleration and putting all that weight on those, whatever hand it is. And I think the right hand makes it even more difficult. So it's that was not good news. And on Saturday, there was some uncertainty whether Rossi would start the race at all on Sunday. And which, interestingly enough, Rossi has not missed a GP start in his career yet. Right. So
191 races. Right.
And so I'm sure that he wanted to keep that going. Plus, he also, because of the way the championship points and everything were going, he was up on Pedrosa. The only way that Pedrosa could come in second in the championship was for Pedrosa to pick up 25 points on him. And so basically, Rossi had to, or Pedrosa would have to win the race, and Rossi would have to not score a single point. And so, you know, that's a done deal. Oh, you know, looks like Rossi has second place locked up, right?
Right.
Yeah, and then unfortunately,
and he starts way at the back of the grid.
Exactly, starts 17th on the grid because he broke his hand about 10 minutes into the qualifying session, and that was where the time put him. And then the rest is somewhat history, which I guess we'll go ahead and jump ahead to the race part to tell you about that. But as you may know, if you're listening to the show, had a bike problem of some sort or another, which I didn't get any details on. Did you, Jules?
No, they have not released anything. I've been watching his website and the Yamaha press releases for any news about what happened to the bike. But well, obviously, they're not going to tell us exactly what happened. But all we know is that there was a mechanical failure, and he had to pull in.
Right. It was suitably vague, MotoGP-ish, yeah, mechanical failure sort of a thing, and not saying. But his body language told wonders, I think, as he went into the pits of just pretty much crushing heartbreak, because at that point in the race, Pedrosa had a strong, firm lead. It looked like Pedrosa was going to be winning the race, and then Rossi has to retire for whatever reason, because initially the commentators, Nick Harris and what's-his-face, were, you know, oh yeah, the pain must have been just too great, and this and that and the other. You know, jumping to the conclusion that he was retiring due to the hand, mm-hmm. and then you know immediately we're told that it was a bike issue.
We should also mention that he actually had fought 14th spot, so
yes.
He did have 2 points, which would have given him that second position. Which at this point, really, I mean, for the last two or three races, that was his championship fight at this point.
Exactly. And I think it was a personal thing for Rossi, too, that it's like, you know, it's bad enough that I'm not winning the championship, but God, I'm not going to be third. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I'm not going to be third to Pedrosa.
Yeah, that might have been part
Pedrosa.
Of it. Yeah, and it's just, yeah. And so I think that was just a crushing defeat for him. You know, he must be very upset. And although it's good news for Pedrosa, it is bad news for Rossi, and, you know, we sympathize with him. The rest of the race, though, it was, you know, pretty much good stuff. Hayden got off to a smashing start, I think, relatively speaking, but faded. It's just the tires. And the tires, Pedrosa managed to seem to do better tire management, but he was by far the top Michelin finisher.
Yep.
And, yeah, let's see, a little bit of details on what happened throughout the race. Like I said, we did have... where's my lap chart? There's my lap chart. Stoner, you know, got the whole shot, of course. There's a shocker. And actually, Hayden didn't get a smashing start. I'm looking at the lap chart. What am I talking about?
No, he did. He faded in the first lap.
Yeah, he did okay. And then, yeah, he just... his tires started going off, and you can see the progression down the lap chart. And but Stoner got the whole shot. It started to look a little bit like it was going to be the usual thing. He never could break away from Pedrosa completely, and then eventually Pedrosa managed to pass him on lap 6. And Pedrosa ended up somewhat breaking away from Stoner. So, let's see. This is not really the most organized race wrap-up I've ever done, is it, Jules?
Well, it's totally fine. There were a couple of battles that were important to watch. Melandri, Hopkins, and Vermeulen were fighting for the fourth spot. This is a racetrack where Melandri has done a really good job in the last 3 years, I believe. I mean, 2 years ago, he was the runner-up in the championship. Remember, he beat Nicky on that last corner to win the race.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It kind of started. It kind of was. He's always, anyway. He's always run really well here. So he was looking good to take. I was actually thinking he would take that fourth spot in the championship due to a good result in Valencia. But Hopkins was unbelievably fast.
Yes,
and
yes,
very aggressive riding too, especially in that last section where you go from some very fast corners to some too slow corners, and then that crazy, you know, tightening 270-degree corner that kind of is the signature Valencia corner. He said the machine was working really well, but it was kind of, you know, by the last few laps, it was kind of a procession for the first four spots.
Yeah,
exactly. And then you had a really good fight between, surprise, surprise, Caparossi and Vermeulen, who actually have locked horns quite a few times, which is interesting because now they're teammates.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was a good race for Barros as well. He always has done fairly well at this track and finished seventh.
Yeah, indeed. They not too bad of a deal there. And with Melandri and Hopkins, as they were going into this race, you know, we had all year long, Hopkins and Vermeulen were looking pretty strong for like fourth and fifth for the Suzuki. And it's, you know, this constant thing of, wow, you know, two Suzukis in the top five. And then Melandri managed to pick up the points, you know, Malaysia with his second spot and everything and got in there. And you did have a three-way thing going on there where they all could have, you know, the Suzuki still could have pulled off the two top five finishes.
Yeah.
But to watch that battle was good because they were, you know, these guys were racing, you know, it's important for them to finish the season on a good note for a lot of reasons. And plus then we got to see the famous Hopper 12 o'clock wheelie across the finish line. One of these days he's going to drop it. I tell you that. that was entertaining stuff. Darren Carpenter, longtime MotoGPOD listener and club racer up there in Portland and all that, made a really cool spreadsheet that kind of analyzes the stuff. And did you get a chance to take a look at that much?
No, I did not. Sorry.
No, it's cool stuff. It shows their. He took the data that we get from the MotoGP website and sort of analyzed it together. So we have Hopkins versus Melandri and Vermeulen versus Caparossi and things, and seeing some of the points that you can gather from their sector times and their overall lap times and their trap speed and things like that. It sort of raises some interesting stuff, like with Hopkins and Melandri. Melandri had the fastest trap speed every lap on that one, which shows us something that we knew already, that the fastest trap speed does not necessarily mean your fastest lap time. And however, Hopkins' bike was second slowest in top speed, but Vermeulen Suzuki was tied for second best at 297.8, while Hopkins' best top speed was 287.9. And first you might think that Suzuki was providing some better support for Vermeulen to get his bike to perform better and beat Hopkins in the championship. But after lap four, Hopkins never had anyone to draft behind, so his top speed suffered, whereas Vermeulen was always in someone's draft on the front straight, which improved his top speed.
Interesting.
I thought this was really interesting stuff. Darren put quite a bit of analysis into this whole thing, and it was, you know, you sort of read it, and you're like, oh, yeah, you know. And the Kawasaki's. The Kawasaki's are so fast in a straight line, they just can't seem to turn that into a overall lap time. But I think that next year...
Yeah, maybe that could just be the riders.
Exactly. I'm really looking forward to next year. I want to, you know, of course, you know, now we've got a couple of months of nothing but some tests and things like that. So we're all looking forward to next year. But I think it's going to be an interesting season, to say the least. Because why don't we finish real quick with this race wrap up, and then we can talk a little bit about the 125s, because now that was the race of the weekend, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But real quick, going down the line of what actually happened, let's find the appropriate piece of paper here. for the MotoGP race at Valencia, the final one of the season. There it is. Danny Pedrosa won it, taking the top spot. He was 5.5 seconds ahead of Casey Stoner in second and 20 seconds ahead of John Hopkins in third. So it was a bit, you know, a bit of a runaway there. Pedrosa had a good lead on Stoner, and Stoner was doing a lonely second place sort of a thing. So that rounds out our podium. Fourth spot went to Marco Melandri, fifth to Loris Capirossi, sixth Christopher Mühlen, seventh Alex Barros, eighth Nicky Hayden. Somewhat, like I said, somewhat disappointing race, a fading there in the second half.
Yeah, this is a racetrack that he also does well at usually. Obviously, took third last year, which got him that championship, and the year before was second.
Mm-hmm. And then 2 years before that, I think he crashed out. But he last year he was a little bit in maintenance mode. He knew he could have the championship by maintaining. You know, his pit board had told him that Rossi was out or down, out of, you know, far enough down.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if he would have been able to catch those Ducatis, though. It would have been hard.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, in any case, it's something of a point. But, yeah, that's a good point. Let's see, going on down. Randy Dipugnier finishing ninth on the Kawasaki. Tony Elias, 10th. Sylvain Guintoli, 11th. Good effort from him. He's going to be one to watch next year. Carlos Checa, 12th. Colin Edwards, 13th. Shinya Nakano, 14th. Makoto Tomata, 15th, picking up the last championship point there. And then Ant West, 16th. And not classified, Valentino Rossi with that retirement due to some sort of mechanical failure. And Curtis Roberts, unfortunately, we don't have any details on what happened to Curtis either. He pulled out after on about the 10th lap. And that's a bit of a shame because, Team Roberts had that cool livery going on where they put everybody's names that had signed up on their website and all that. And it was neat. And who knows what's going on. And then Chaz Davis didn't even start. He, some injuries were aggravated and just felt that the best decision was to not even start the race from the back of the grid there.
Yeah.
So that pretty much covers the final race there of the season. A little bit of a, you know, like I said, the championship had been decided and everything else. So, you know, good stuff, but whatever.
There was a lot of shakeup, though, in the manufacturers and team championship, because remember coming into this race, obviously Ducati had 103, but it was Yamaha that had second spot in the team championship, and Suzuki behind them, and then Repsol Honda, which was probably a pretty big embarrassment to Repsol, who would not like to have finished the year fourth.
Mm-hmm.
But because of Danny's result and because of Nicky's, you know, fighting eighth,
right? Sure.
They actually ended up beating both those teams, and because Suzuki had the good result, well, Yamaha had a terrible result. Yamaha ended up in the fourth spot.
Right, and that team, yeah, exactly. And looking at the points, I mean, they're separated by 4 points. Those three teams.
Right.
We don't hear a lot about the team standings exactly all the time, but they are significant to the teams. I don't think it's quite like it is in say, Formula One or something, where it's almost more important for the team than for the rider. But yeah, so that's a good point there, Jules. Interesting stuff. But let's talk a little bit about the 125 race.
Okay.
Because yes, indeed. And Jules, you've been following the 125s a little more closely this year than I have. So do you want to kind of lead us off?
To be honest, I haven't really been following them that closely, but there aren't any riders that I particularly know very well, so it's kind of hard to get like attached to anybody. But I knew that it was a good race brewing because there was a very interesting situation for the championship leaders, Gabor Talmaxi and Hector Fabel, because they're on the same team, and they were the only ones who could actually win the championship. Talmaxi was 10 points ahead of Fabel, and they're both on the Espar team, and they can there were no team orders, obviously, because right. there was no chance of the team losing that championship. So the team was like, you know, I don't care what you guys do, because they can go out there and they can both crash, and the team still wins.
Right. Yeah. You know? So they were far enough ahead, and
so we knew that there was something. And Fubel is a great rider, and Tom Axie has been a great rider all year, and 125 races are close, so it's one of the races that I just made sure I was going to watch, and it was so worth it. It was definitely the most entertaining, not necessarily the best race in terms of like you know, seeing amazing skill, but just totally entertaining. I was literally laughing out loud as I was watching this race. It was so fun to watch.
It was.
And, you watched it last night.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, it was great stuff. And like Nick Harris said, you know, they're bashing fairings and locking handlebars. And I mean, there were some close calls. There were some good stuff. And one guy on Team Aspar that did have team orders was the third rider, Sergio Gadea.
Don't screw
it up.
Yeah, don't screw it up.
And because there was a lot of sort of individual for each rider, there was a lot of strategizing, because if Fauxball had won and Talmaxi did not finish on the podium, then Fauxball got the championship.
Right.
And sort of almost any other result, you know, Talmaxi gets the championship, because that 10-point difference was not quite enough to lock it in for Talmaxi going into that race. And both these guys knew it, and they both had their own strategies going on of what they were going to do, and it was just insane. I mean, every looking at the lap chart, if you just, you know, if you're one of those, it doesn't mean anything. You look at the lap chart, and
it looks like Talmaxi was leading the entire time.
Yeah, led every single lap except the critical last lap.
Right.
And even that, you know, but that's just the lap chart. If you actually watched the race, it was insane. Actually, no, Talmaxi did not lead the first lap either, because the start was incredible. You had all these guys from the back of the grid zoom right up, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
But, you know, you got a grid, 37 riders out there, all. It's like a NASCAR race. But every lap, there were lead changes. You know, just these short little quick, we passed him, and then he takes it back. And
I want to make a couple of interesting like points about this. So there's 9 Spanish riders in the race, and 1 Hungarian rider. Everybody's been comparing this race to the race many years ago with Loris Caparossi, I believe, right?
Right. The Italian mafia.
And yeah. So there was some interesting stuff going on where you could almost you could tell that there was a little bit of national camaraderie going on, where they were going to try and stop Talmaxi from winning the world championship. I mean, here they are on Spanish soil, and you've got all these Spanish riders.
Talmaxi and Fauxball do not get along at all. This is not a happy team.
Well, I don't think anybody gets along with Talmaxi. I mean, you know, he's definitely in it for himself. Remember that incident with him and Callio last year when Callio actually had a chance to win the championship, and a few rounds from the end, I don't remember which race it was at, but Talmaxi looked like he was in a supporting position behind Callio the entire race, sitting right behind him, and then the last corner he pulled out of the slipstream and won the race, and those 5 points ended up costing Callio the championship.
Yes, and Callio was not a happy camper about that.
No.
No.
And neither was the team.
No.
The team fired Gabor, and there was some talk about him not returning. Anyway, so in the race itself, the only strategy that... because Aspar has been really just kind of a runaway team during the season, which is why, like, this season wasn't really as exciting as this particular race. The two of them were kind of on their own, and there was like a 8-second gap by mid race to the next guy, who was there was a fight between Pessini and Pasek, and the only chance that Fabel had of beating Talmaxi was not just to win, but to get three or two other guys to pass Talmaxi.
Exactly.
So
keep him off
his
the podium.
Strategy, he was obviously faster. He had a better pace, race pace. It was absolutely clear that he had a better race pace. He was catching up to Talmaxi and then passing him and then doing everything to try and slow Talmaxi down.
Right.
And it looked like it wasn't really working, but then a few laps from the end, you even see like this great shot. Well, Talmaxi looks behind him, and he sees there's bikes coming, and there's like a train of three bikes coming, which is Gadea, Pacini, and Pasek,
and some lapped riders in there as well,
and some lapped riders in there as well. Yeah. And I want to also mention that there was this very interesting incident with Jean Olive, uh-huh. who's another Spanish writer who writes for Aprilia Polaris, and he was got lapped early in the race, and then, well, not early, like halfway through the race, he got lapped. And the moment he got lapped, he stuck to the front guys, Fabel and Talmaxi, and it looked like he was going to try and slow. Like he was looking for, it almost looked like he was going to look for a chance to get, when Fabel passed Talmaxi, that he would try to get in between them and yeah. try and also slow down Talmaxi, which is, you know, that whole, the Spanish mafia now.
Exactly. I agree. And that lends credibility to that theory, if you ask me. Because Olive is not a bad rider. And
no.
for him to be lapped at Valencia was a little, And then.
And there was always body language. He was looking back to check of,
oh, yeah.
Are they coming? You know, it's a very distinctive bike that Aspar runs. They've got that little asterisk in the front
mm-hmm.
Of the bike. He's looking probably for that. And I just found that amazing. But then Fabel basically was just looking for places where he could get his bike in front of Talmaxi and actually just slow down. And there was a couple of times where he just would look back. You know, you could tell he was slowing down. He was making sure that Talmaxi's line was blocked, or there was a couple of times when tires almost touched, and it looked like he wanted to do this in a clean way in terms of the race rules, but
but that's about it.
Man, he was pushing it. He was really pushing it. There was a couple of corners there where he was it looked like he was going to undercut Talmaxi's rear. I think he was very frustrated because basically there was no chance for him unless those guys caught up. And then at the very last lap, on the last corner, we've got Gadea catching up, Pacini, Pasek. On the very last corner, they're all coming out. You can't even really tell what's happening. Fabel could win the race.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at that point he decided, okay, I've done everything I could. I need to win this race to kind of just like say, hey, at least I won the race, right?
Sure, exactly.
And then it looked like Gadea may have actually had to back off a little bit because he may have taken Talmaxi. And Pacini and Pesek were within just a few. I mean, those guys all finished within a 0.8 of a second.
And you had Olive in the mix as well. So you had a whole slew of bikes crossing the line at the same time.
Right.
And it did almost even at that last corner. Talmaxi had a bit of a moment as Fabel passed him, and it almost looked like he was going to get passed by the other guys. And,
yeah.
They were that close. I mean, everything. Yeah, it wasn't the closest finish in 125. History or whatever, which I can't remember that race, but the one where it was like a tire's width.
Right.
that one was insane. But, it was a good race. It really was an exciting edge of the seat race and a credit to these guys' talents and the effort that they put into it and really the strength of the 125 class in its own right. And I mean, these guys are running lap times that are only a few seconds off MotoGP. It's because it's so much of a, about the carry and the corner speed and that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
And it's good racing. It really is. And it's a shame that speed waits like you know, Speed TV waits, what, 2 weeks or something like that to show the races all the time. Doesn't get enough credit. And then they don't come to Laguna Seca, which reminds me, Laguna Seca tickets went on sale last Monday. And I should have mentioned this a show or two ago. But go to laguna-seca.com, buy your race tickets for next July. So I think, do we want to run down the whole 125? I think we've covered it well enough, yeah.
So in the end, Tomaxi did win the championship, and Aspar got the full podium because Gadea was third.
Yes, yes,
so,
exactly.
There were some very happy, the team was very relieved, nobody cried. So there was a couple of takeaways to the, like, to the team. Members, various team members, as the race was going on, and they were just all just like shaking their heads, like, "Oh God, what? Just please don't hurt yourselves."
But you could also tell a whole lot of body language. They brought out the championship number one T-shirt for Talmaxi, and he puts it on over his leathers and everything. I don't think Fauble and Talmaxi made eye contact the entire time, let alone any congratulation or anything. Yeah.
There was a very, very specific conversation, hugging, congratulations between Fauble and Gadea.
Oh yeah,
but not even a look over at Talmaxi the entire time. They went up to the podium when they were being interviewed. Mm-hmm. It got very cold in there.
Yeah, it did. And Pacini was right after Talmaxi won the race, and they're on the cool down lap and everything. Pacini basically came over, and then there was a hearty congratulations sort of a thing going on. Mm-hmm. So they must at least somewhat get along. The Fauble and Talmaxi obviously not big friends, and they made comments. Nick Harris did during that part for May when they brought out that T-shirt and all of that business, that you had to have had two sets of everything prepared.
Exactly.
You don't know who is gonna win the championship, and so there would have been Hector Fauble world champion shirts, and then Gabor Talmaxi world champion shirts, and all prepped up, and so you hustle the other ones off to be destroyed or sold on eBay or whatever happens to them.
And the alternate universe.
Exactly, t-shirt. The alternate bizarro world. Yes, I've heard stories of people being donated clothes, like in very, very poor countries and things like that. And you'll see some guy wearing a Super Bowl shirt for the team that did not win.
Oh wow!
Like that. Yeah, where they get sent off. And say, thank you, America. We love your Eagles or whatever the football team that didn't win. But
the Buffalo Bills.
Yes.
Number one. I have shirts from 4 years. All right. So yeah, it was an incredible race. Since this might actually be kind of good for some people, since if you haven't watched it and it is coming up on Speed eventually,
yes,
it's definitely worth taping whatever and watching it. It really was.
It is.
Even though we've
kind of spoiled the ending for you, the race itself is so. I will watch it again. It was like that, and it was a really, really entertaining race. And yeah, part of that might have been because of the Fauble strategizing. That kept the racing closer because basically he would pass and try to keep things a little bit slower. Whatever the reason was, it made for an excellent race.
Yeah,
and I thought that was good stuff. So, other stuff that's been kind of going on, we had some testing happening in Valencia. That everybody went to their new teams. I saw Depinier wearing his new LCR leathers and all of that, which, interestingly enough, now I've got listeners sending me photos where Depinier's chest is visible. And I don't need to see Randy Depinier's chest, folks. Thank you very much. that whole thing was just a comment because, two races in a row, and then Grace over there at the Formula1blog.com podcast had mentioned it, so it was kind of an all-around joke. But he got a shot of Randy Depinier with his leathers unzipped. And so in any case, everybody's going to their new teams, and they're getting in the press of making comments about how much they love the new motorcycle and et cetera, et cetera. And we're sort of waiting for the thing. And other official truly announcements where the nail is in the coffin on the deal. Rossi will be on Bridgestones. I believe that one came out the weekend of Valencia.
Yep.
Which is really an interesting situation altogether. And Yamaha had a little press release saying that they're in effect going to be running two pit boxes because Bridgestone and Michelin, we don't need to have a sort of a any data stealing between the two.
Yeah, it's going to be very similar to the way that Sito Pons ran his team in 2005 with Tamada and Biaggi.
Right.
Where you had, sorry, that was 2004, where you actually had a divider in the garages that was brought in every time because Tamada was on Bridgestones and Biaggi was on Michelin's.
Right. So, yeah, so there is a precedent for it. Like you said, it will make things a little weird, especially since part of Lorenzo's thing is that, you know, I'm going to get the equal equipment of Rossi and then this and that and the other. And in effect, he might, if he's paranoid, have this sort of nagging feeling in the back of his head of not knowing that, you know, it's like, what's Yamaha doing? And that kind
of
thing.
Yeah. On the other hand, he's the guy who's going to have the data that he could share with two other riders,
right?
Because Edwards and James Toseland are going to be on Michelin's, and I think Rossi's the one that's going to have a disadvantage. I mean, he's going to have the most support probably from the factory, and he does have Jeremy Burgess, but I think he's taking a huge risk because he's going to be the only Yamaha rider on Bridgestone. Yamaha has never been on Bridgestone before. It'll be really interesting to see what they can do.
Do you think it's a little premature? I mean, 1 year of Michelin not getting it right and Rossi jumped ship. And this is not a, you know.
I don't think it's premature because I don't think that this is the first year that Rossi has been fed up with Michelin.
Okay.
I think
it's kind of the capper. He's just, this is, I'm
yeah,
done.
I think that 2006 was when he already was, he wasn't really necessarily saying anything about it. He did a couple of times, but, you know, I mean, he had, what, 3 DNFs because of tires?
Really?
In 2006?
Yeah.
And then the same, and he, you know, he basically, I think, blames the tire for his crash in Valencia, which, you know, I mean, I guess the equipment can always be blamed, but, you know, that is part of racing. It's not just the man.
No.
There is a machine involved, and the machine did fail, and, you know, that just happened. So, but, I think it's much more than just this season. I think it's been something that he's just, you know, he's switched motorcycle brand and tire brand. It'd be interesting if he actually could pull off a championship. That would be a history setting.
Yeah. Especially, like you say, with a little bit of the disadvantage of being the only Yamaha guy in Bridgestones and all of that. I think that's going to be somewhat telling.
Yep. Hey, so there's an interesting, I just went to the MotoGP.com website and there's an interesting survey there, which is, I wanted to ask you what you think. Who will be the most successful rider with his new team in 2008? So these are the guys who have switched teams. So the choices are Loris Caparossi, John Hopkins, Jorge Lorenzo, Marco Melandri, Randy DePugne, or other?
Okay. When you first asked the question, I was just going to jump out of the gate and say Hopkins. But then since they're putting Lorenzo in the mix, I'd say Lorenzo. But see, I don't think that really counts. He's not switching teams. He's totally switching classes and all of that. If you talk about guys that were in MotoGP last year and have switched
teams. Let's remove Lorenzo.
Yeah. Then I would say Hopkins.
Hopkins on the Kawasaki.
Mm-hmm. What about you?
I agree. I think Hopkins and Kawasaki is going to be the most successful. But the interesting thing is that by far, the vote so far is going to Marco Melandri.
Really?
And I think this is. I mean, Melandri is a great rider, and I love the way he rides. And I think he is going to be very successful on that bike. But it just shows how Stoner. Stoner is still not getting the credit for this incredible season that he had. I think that people are just like, oh, well, Melandri is going to be on the Ducati and Bridgestone, which is the reason why Stoner won the championship. So obviously he's going to be the one that's going to be doing the best. And I think that's that Stoner will never shake that until he wins the second championship, which I think that he is going to be a contender next year, absolutely, because as we know in testing, he has already led both the testing sessions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And Stoner mentioned something that came up in the news that he doesn't feel that he's even getting the credibility, the whatever, in the paddock. Even, you know, not just it's everybody, you know, and you gotta feel for the guy of this, you know, the fans, the press, and even the rest of the paddock are thinking that he just lucked in to this super fantastic motorcycle and that he's Joe Schlub average rider that got the magic bike. And that's not fair. That's not, because otherwise, why is Caparossi so far down? And, yeah. You know, that's the one right there. That's the one thing you can say of that, you know, and I mean, of course, there's arguments of, well, this and that and the other, but I don't think those arguments have a lot of merit. And yeah, I agree. But Marco will do well next year too.
He will do well, there's tracks where he is brilliant at, and there's tracks where he is not so brilliant at, and then he finishes, you know, barely in the top 10. Whereas Hopkins this year has been extremely consistent. The only times where he hasn't done well was when he ran off the track for some reason. But when he's on, he is in the top five, you know?
Yes.
And the Kawasaki, a lot of people say, may be one of the best bikes in the paddock.
Right. And also, I'm going to go out on a limb here a little bit, but some aspects of Hopkins' style might be suited to the Kawasaki with this straight line speed issue. I don't know, that it's just, he's not as much of a point and shoot guy as we've always seen, like from Hayden and so many of the other former dirt track types. But, I think that it might fit. I really do.
Oh yeah. He definitely has corner speed down with Suzuki. I mean, that's been their strength for pretty much the entire time he's been there. So I think he's learned to ride in a way that is good for 800cc bikes. And maybe you're right. Maybe because of he can carry that speed through the corners.
If he can overcome the possible shortcomings of whatever it is about the Kawasaki that is that, so if he can basically bring the corner speed talent from the Suzuki to the Kawasaki and continue to keep the high corner speed up, then on top of that, the straight line speed, you know, he might be a major force to be reckoned with. How does that sound? Is that a good theory?
Yeah.
Okay. I liked it, and I just made it up.
The testing has been pretty, you know, it's mildly interesting. Melandri has not had a great time on the new bike yet. Actually, no, he's right. He's testing on the 2007 Ducati first, and he got a second faster by day two, and he's speaking. Like he's finally started. Like the comment he made was that he had like an aha moment, and he realized what it is that makes the Ducati so incredibly potent. And that he says that in the next few sessions he should be doing a lot better because he finally kind of figured out the trick, quote unquote. And then the new Honda was unveiled, and it's you know what? Is it a pneumatic engine? I actually forgot to check.
Oh, well, yes. And
you're going to have to check that because I'm not going to be able to look it up and splice that into the show later.
Okay. I'll put it in somewhere somehow. I'm going to put it in right here. It's a pneumatically valved engine, folks. The Honda RC212V for 2008 has a larger chassis, an all-new exhaust system, and an engine with pneumatic valves.
Yes.
Well, I think that we both are at our deadline of when we have to make this call end, because real life intrudes the way it has an annoying habit of doing so. And it was fun talking to you. It always is.
And everybody watch the 125 race when you get a chance.
Yes, definitely. you can either watch it online, MotoGP.com. You can watch it on Speed whenever the hell they end up finally showing it, like maybe December after a rerun of Pink or something. And, you know, who knows? I'll also find out when that's going to be on, and I will add that. And that race is going to be shown on Speed on Tuesday, November 13th, and it's at 9 a.m. Pacific or 12 noon Eastern. So Tuesday, November 13th, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern. Okay. So thanks a lot, Jules. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Bob. Ciao.
Jules and I briefly mentioned Darren Carpenter's analysis that he did of Valencia during our call there, but we didn't talk about it enough. I really wanted to kind of cover this a little bit more because it's pretty neat, and Darren put a lot of work into it, and I actually am going to put it up on the website for you to download. There will be a link at motogpod.com. And a couple of things, because I can't sort of communicate all this information just by talking about it, so I'm going to give you the highlights real quick. What he did was he compared several different riders in pairs, like Pedrosa versus Stoner, Hopkins versus Melandri, Vermeulen versus Caparossi, and so on and so forth, and it's really interesting because we're getting the insight of a guy who has raced motorcycles and has set up motorcycles for the racetrack and the things that he thinks might be happening and what might be explaining some of the differences that we're seeing in their sector times, overall top speed, lap times, that sort of thing. And so, like, for instance, in the Pedrosa versus Stoner section, Darren has all of their lap times and sector times listed out. And we see that on all the laps where Stoner was in the lead, which was the first five laps of the race, he had a lower top speed, except for one lap. His top speed was lower, and Pedrosa's was higher for those laps. And then the laps where Pedrosa led, which was, 6 through 30, the reverse was true. By and large, Stoner had the higher top speed. And Darren says, the only time that Pedrosa had a better top speed is when he was drafting behind Stoner. Once Pedrosa passed Stoner, Stoner's top speed was faster on every lap because he was drafting Pedrosa. This illustrates, and we mentioned this in the call, but this illustrates the importance of that drafting and why it works and how they, we all know, we've seen it happen. We know the somewhat of the physics behind it all, that there's less air resistance so he can zip out and all of that sort of thing. But it's still sort of interesting to see it on paper with all these numbers. Then Darren also noticed that Pedrosa was faster in Sector 4. And as you know, of course, the racetrack is divided up into sectors. And so Pedrosa was consistently faster in Sector 4, which leads onto the front straight. And it probably helps explain why Stoner, even with his higher top speed under the drafting, was not able to catch and draft by Pedrosa. Because the most important turn is that one that leads you onto the front straight, onto the longest straight. And in this case, that was the Sector 4, and Pedrosa was faster in Sector 4 on every lap. Pedrosa was also faster in Sector 2, whereas Stoner was faster in Sector 3. But looking at the track map, it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of good passing opportunities in Sector 3. So Darren's opinion is, and it's a good one, he thinks that Pedrosa was not as concerned about getting his bike set up for that sector, Sector 3, of the track, and that he was more concerned about carrying his corner speed in Sector 4 to lead onto the front straight. And if that's true, that turned out to be a very good strategy on Pedrosa's part. And these are some of the insights that you're going to get from a guy who set up a motorcycle for racing. And when he's talking in the section about Checa versus Nakano, you got two guys riding pretty much the same bike, the satellite team bike, and then not the best funded satellite team bike, for two different teams. And although in the race, Checa finished 12th and Nakano finished 14th, you look at the data here, and Nakano had a good first five laps, and then he dropped from there. But he had a better top speed in all but one lap. Why? Maybe because he geared for maximum top speed, or he set up his bike for that sector in Sector 4 to get onto the front straight. Or maybe he really liked the last turn before the front straight and he nailed it every time. But in any event, these are things to show you that the one turn, one sector, and top speed just doesn't make the whole race. And it really is kind of interesting stuff. You got to download this chart and take a look at it. I think it's well worth a quick examination. He said, I got also the comparison for every rider for lap 6 through 25. First five laps are thrown out because somebody might have had a bad start or qualified poorly and got stuck in some traffic. Last five laps are thrown out because maybe racers slowed up to save their tires and just protect their position. So laps 6 through 25 are the meat of the race. Vermeulen would have finished in fourth place and less than 3 seconds behind Hopkins. Vermeulen was also the second most consistent racer with all of his laps within 6/10 of each other. DePunier was the least consistent rider. Surprising? Probably not. Stoner was the most consistent rider. Surprising? Probably not. And then he says Elias was the fifth most consistent rider with only 0.6 tenths, 0.672 seconds separating his fastest and slowest laps. Surprising? Yes. So special thanks to Darren for prepping that spreadsheet up for us. I thought it was cool stuff. Like I said, I will put a link up on the MotoGPOD website. You'll see it in the episode notes. Go ahead and download it. Take a look if you got Excel. It's kind of fun to take a look at. And thanks a lot, Darren. All right. We got Chuck Axelin on the phone today. Come from England. How are you doing today, Chuck?
Doing okay, Bob. I guess it's Thursday night over here and a bit blustery outside. Got my fire going, so I'm all set.
Yep. Winter has started to arrive, hasn't it? It's getting chilly over here, too, so...
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And you just came back from sunny Spain where at least it was a little warmer, wasn't it?
Yeah, the weather in Spain was good for the whole weekend, so can't complain. You know, very rarely can you complain about the weather in Spain, to be honest. It's normally pretty nice, and then when you come back to the UK and the time has changed and it starts getting back dark early and, you know, it's dark when you wake up, it gets, for me now, it's kind of the depressing part of being here in the UK, but... That's life, and then just got to plow through it.
So, speaking of Spain, you had your special livery down there, which I guess you guys had a huge success on that. Was it better than your expectations, the numbers that you had, or tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I didn't really know what to expect, to be honest with you. We ended up with 15,502 names in basically the span of 6 days is how long we could run it for, because... You know, the response was so great. We figured, if we don't shut it down a little bit early, there's no way we're going to get everybody on there. And from that aspect, it was good. There was a lot of good feedback, great comments, and, you know, having all the names on the bike. If you ever got a chance to get up close or see a picture or, you know, look up your own name on the bike, it's pretty cool to just see everybody's names around it. And you just kind of get lost in this maze trying to pick out who's who and so forth. So no, really happy with that, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, cool. No, I did get a chance to see the on your website where you have the search for your name, and I thought it was very well done, and I downloaded like a PDF of the actual sort of decal, and oh, there I am. I was on the left nose down towards the bottom, and I thought it came out really good. And did you guys end up using more of the real estate available than you had initially planned?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it started out, the idea was let's replace the rear number with a KR logo and let's put everybody's name in that. And, after the first 2 days, our website guys, ClearSight, called and said, look, we just need every available space you have on the bike because there's no way it's all going to fit in that number area. So yeah, we ended up using, the side of the seat and as much on the side of the fairing as we could, and the front fender and the top of the seat and the top of the gas tank as well.
Wow. Yeah. So no, I thought it was a great idea and it was cool. And I'm glad you guys got a lot of exposure, and it should also tell the team that, you do have a lot of fans and that there are a lot of people rooting for you and all of that. I'm sure you already knew that, but it's probably still nice to sort of have it in writing, so to speak.
Well, it was nice to give something back, and all the emails. There were a lot of people that had a lot of different reasons for putting either their own name or their children's name on the bike, or friends that had passed away and giving them one more ride type of thing. And it was really good. And some of the emails we got were very heartwarming. And the people that put their children's name on it, they brought up that now at that race in Valencia, the kids were watching. Not only, the guys running in the front or whatever, but they're looking for the Team Roberts bike because they know they're a part of it. So from that aspect, it was a really cool thing. So we had a lot of fun with it, and hopefully we'll be able to do it again some day next year.
Sure, sure. I mean, it's one of those concepts you wouldn't necessarily want to wear out, but you could certainly do it, again and all that. Was the aspect of people putting on, memories for passed away friends or children, was that something you had anticipated, or was, because I never even thought of that until you said that?
Yeah, not really. And it was something that just, again, the feedback that we got, that a lot of people had a lot of different reasons for doing it. And, some were in memory and, of friends or buddies that, had raced and, give them another ride type thing. And, the kids thing, and I guess from some, that aspect, I could share a little bit because my daughter was one of the first people that, hey, I'm going to put my name on it, So it was a good way to, you know, involve everybody basically. And there were a lot of people that had a lot of different reasons for doing it. And I'm glad that we could, you know, provide that opportunity. Definitely.
Yeah, no, it was a cool deal. I resisted putting on MotoGPOD. I just put on Bob Hayes, but reading through some of the other names, I should have put a plug for the podcast on there. One last question on it, not to beat a dead horse, but did you get any like real famous people? Did Brad Pitt put his name on your motorcycle?
No, Brad Pitt didn't. We had one guy that put Valentino Rossi on it, and I'm sure it wasn't Valentino, but this guy's theory was, you know, he's always wanted to see Valentino Rossi ride a KR bike, and this was probably the one way it was going to get done the quickest. So he had Valentino's name on there. There was David Coulthard on there, the Formula One driver. But again, we're not sure if, you know, it was actually him or not. It could have been a fan of his wanting his name on the bike too. But
sure.
You know, Randy Mamola, there were a lot of journalists that took part in it, and you know, there could be some famous people on there. But you know, I didn't get a chance to read all 15,000 names.
No, and yeah, and without the verification. But no, it's cool that you had such a great response. So, and the race of Valencia, we saw Curtis retire. What were the details on that? What happened there?
Well, basically, we were looking pretty much forward to a good race there. And on race tires, we weren't that far away from the other Michelin runners. And, you know, when during the qualifying session, before everybody went to qualifiers, we were about 3/10 off Nicky's pace. So Curtis was quite confident he could run with, you know, Nakano and those guys, which were just a little bit ahead. And sort of from the get-go, the engine just didn't really run right off the bottom, and it was very inconsistent. And sometimes you'd open the throttle, and it would pick up, and other times it wouldn't pick up, and then just kind of hit very hard. So it just got worse as the race went on. And, you know, those things are sometimes pretty hard to ride in those situations. So it just became too difficult for him, and, you know, he pulled it in.
Yeah, and it was a shame. I was hoping that you guys would be able to put in a good performance.
Well, it's just kind of a cap off to the year, really. You know, it's we haven't had the best of season, and you know, I think it's pretty public that, you know, we haven't really got any upgrades from Honda with the motor. And you know, I'm sure Honda will turn it around and have a good package next year. And, you know, we wish them the best of luck next year. But, it wasn't meant to be. It was a frustrating year for us. And it's kind of relieved to get it over with, to be honest.
Oh, wow. But, well, in any event, a year, you know, time to move on. And now, is there any sort of details that we're having yet about next year? I know that a lot of this is probably still in the works, but what can you tell us?
Well, it's still in the works, basically. You hit the nail on the head. We're, first off, trying to put the sponsorship together. We have talked to Ducati about, the potential for working with them, and they know what we're trying to put together, and I think it'll be a program that they would like to be a part of. So, you know, first step is get the money in place, and if we're able to put the program together that we are looking for, then it'll be not just a one-year program and trying to survive. It'll be an opportunity for us to build for the future and look for the next 3 to 5 years.
Okay. Now, there's been some rumors on the internet floating around, which we all know how those work, about Ilmore. Is that something that actually is happening? Not happening necessarily, but something that is a real possibility, or is it just flat-out internet rumor?
It's just more or less internet rumor. We appreciate the effort that Mario Liam has put into, you know, to his project. And, we've always said during the year, hey, let's just kind of keep in touch. And if something were to come up and there were opportunity for either side, let's just, you know, stay in touch. And that's all it was. And I told the journalist, that, and they kind of took it and ran with it like we were in negotiations of some kind. But we haven't really talked to him in the last a couple months anyway. So, our goal is to work with Ducati, and that's the direction we're going.
Cool. Okay. I mean, yeah, and I know from doing my show here that you got to find any little straw you can and clutch at it and turn it into hard news. So,
well, it was a good try anyways, and it kept us, kept people talking about it, I suppose.
Yeah, top of the mind awareness, you know, as long as people are talking about Team KR, that's probably a good thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
As long as they spell it right and all of that. So,
<That's right. laughs>
now is Curtis going to be back next year?
We don't know. We haven't really discussed riders. You know, like I mentioned earlier, first priority is to get the sponsorship together, and then we'll get into detail about the bikes and tires and riders.
Everything else sort of has to fall into place after. I guess that does make a lot of sense.
Well, it's a lot easier to put all the rest of it in place after you, you know, have some security there and you know that you have something to put together. You know, we could go around the paddock talking to riders, talking to manufacturers all day long, but if you don't have sort of step one in place, you're just more or less wasting your time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How did you learn how to be a team manager? Was this all sort of school of hard knocks or?
Yeah, more or less. I more or less grew up with Kenny. You know, our families, our background kind of goes back a long ways. My father was actually Kenny's first sponsor when he was about 14, 15 years old. And, he still works for us, basically. He was Kenny's mechanic for a number of years, dirt track and road racing. And then was turned into the engine development guy with our two strokes and so forth. And, I grew up basically in the lifestyle, more or less. It it's kind of not a job that you picture yourself in the future and you go for it. I started racing when I was, eight, started riding mini bikes when I was three and went to Europe with Kenny in 83. I was racing motocross and he needed somebody to help ride with him and train with him and, to get ready for his last year. And I did that. And then I wanted to go to Europe and sort of see what it was all about. So I went over with him. And when I saw, what Grand Prix were, then I came back and I started road racing myself. And at that time there wasn't a lot of money in American road racing. So gave myself about 3 years and, did a couple of years on a 250 and a superbike. And then, ran out of money and patience for the thing and got involved on the management side, with Kenny's teams. So, just kind of a evolution really, just evolved into this step and, worked with the, Marlboro Yamaha team. I did ran the Formula USA team when we did that back in the 90s, running 500s in America against the big four strokes and stuff. And then when we decided to dissolve the U.S. team, coming over to Europe was the next step. And then when we decided to make our own bike, it involved setting up a factory to do that. So, it wasn't even that I volunteered. It just was assumed I was coming over here, and we did.
You were volunteered.
I was sort of volunteered without saying anything, It was just, I knew somebody had to come over and keep an eye on things and help, keep it under control. And so, here we are. Also, I saw that step as a good experience for my kids. I got two kids that are now 19-year-old daughter, 17-year-old son, and, they've been over here half their life. And, the goal there was to kind of open their eyes and show them there's, more to the world than Modesto, California. So,
oh, sure.
Yeah. So it's been a good experience for them and, for us. And, it's been frustrating at times, but it's, it's been fun at times and it's quite a unique job. And, I always put it towards that it's not really a job, it's just our way of life. And, it's something that you can't say is a 9-to-5 deal because it's, I'll be on the phone to Kenny on the weekends and, it's just not your normal deal. That's for sure.
Then I got a question for you sort of as a MotoGP related question, since you're probably the highest ranking guy that's actually involved in MotoGP that we talk to on a regular basis. I had a listener email me in a question about start money and rider purses. And I had to admit that I truly did not know the answer. I had some assumptions. I know about start money and that the money that basically Dorna pays the teams just to field a rider on the grid. And then I assume there are rider purses. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How does that work?
Well, the rider purse has really got sort of reevaluated a number of years ago. I'm not quite sure when, but it was probably, in the mid to late 90s, I think, because, the teams that are winning really don't need the excess budget that the purse winnings are going to bring to a rider who's under contract making, lots of money anyway. So the idea was to have a system that distributes the money pretty evenly. There's not a big difference between what a winning team and sort of a bottom type team would get as far as overall money per race. So there's no such rider purse per se, but the teams do have an agreement with Dorna, which provides a certain amount of money to start the race, and a certain distribution of the TV funds, and qualifying money, and where you finish. But it's probably not enough. It never is. But certainly it works better than the old who wins the race gets the most money type aspect.
Right. Yeah. Which at the MotoGP level, I guess that's kind of obsolete method of doing it.
Yeah. I mean, the top riders are on a pretty good salary, and for what's available, I mean, I suppose the riders could negotiate, some of the contractual money that the teams get. That's all really up to the agreements that the team makes with the rider. But, and I'm sure everybody works a little bit different, but, basically per se, there's not a $100,000 first prize type thing for winning the race, like a NASCAR type situation has. It's more of an even distribution. And like I said, it's there to ensure that the teams that finish lower on down still get a fairly decent share of the overall funds.
Okay, yeah. So, all right. Well, thanks for expanding our knowledge there a little bit about the way some of the inner workings of MotoGP. Because, like I said, that was a question where I was just like, sort of, well, I don't know. And So it's always kind of interesting.
What'd you and Jules get into?
Oh, we just kind of wrapped up the sort of a Valencia GP wrap up, and then talked a lot about the 125 race. That was spectacular.
It was good. It was good. I mean, obviously, we watch that a lot because we helped Stevie Bonzi. And, it was his last ride for KTM. And he was more or less, when he started the season, his fourth race on a road racer was the Qatar Grand Prix. And he'd never really ridden a 125 except for the preseason testing. And to come from more or less, local dirt tracks in America to that environment and, he actually scored some points. I think he ended up 25th overall in the championship. And there at Valencia, he got a pretty bad start. He was 27th on the first lap, and he ended up just missed out on on 15th and a point when his teammate kind of stuck it under him in the last corner, and he ended up 16th. But he makes it exciting for us to watch that class, definitely.
So that's good, too, that you have some interest that you're going on and things where you can go out there and a reason to follow the 125 races. That's good. So.
No, definitely. It's good to see him progress as well. Like I said, it's in the beginning of the year, we're just going, man, this kid's getting thrown in the deep end, basically. He's 17 years old and never really been outside the United States. And, here he is, like I said, his fourth road race ever was in Qatar, the first race of the year. So, it was good to see his progression in that situation, the guy's going to make mistakes and, hopefully learn from him. And he's a good kid, and I think he's got a bright future ahead of him. And, it was good to see his progression, and, he ended up, the season from not really knowing where he was going and what he was doing to, racing for points. So it was great.
And what's he likely to be doing next year, do you think?
Well, he's, KTM brought him in this year, and they, what they're doing next year is, apparently they're not going to run a factory 125 program on their own. They're going to do some programs with other teams and supply bikes. So right now we're in the works for getting them a ride on Aprilia 125, and we got a couple teams that are in the running for that, and we're just trying to pick the right place and the right program. And actually tomorrow in Spain he's going to be testing a 125 Aprilia, so it'll be good to see what his impression is of that. And it looks fairly likely he'll be back in the Grand Prix next year, and I think he'll be. Again, he should move up another notch, at least knowing, where he's going on the racetrack.
Sure, sure. No, that's great. That's real good news. And so we do hope to see more of him. Yeah.
Yeah, another young American to root for. And, I think it'll be a lot of fun for him to race his home Grand Prix at Indy next year, because the 125s and 250s obviously are going there. So, I think it'll be a fun chance for everybody to cheer him on.
Sure, exactly. And and so many Americans don't come up through the 125, 250 progression, so that'll be interesting to see how that, how does he end up competing against, the Europeans and all that, where that's their normal sort of progression.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, he came from racing at Lodi Cycle Bowl to, you know, to Qatar, you know, in sort of a year. So it'll be a lot more fun to watch him next year. Like I said, he finished the year battling for sort of the tail end of the points, and you know, his best finish through the year was 13th. And I would expect, you know, he'll be chasing points pretty much all next year.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Good. That's great news. So, well, all right. I'm kind of running out of time here. Probably should let you go too, Chuck, because I know you're at home and you want to spend time with your family. Do appreciate your time on the phone. It's always good to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, nice to be here, Bob.
Okay. And we will definitely give you another call again soon when we next time we get a chance.
Okay. Sounds good.
That's going to do it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks very much for downloading it. Don't forget, if you get a chance, catch that 125 race on Speed TV if you're in the United States, November 13th, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. or, noon, 12 noon Eastern time. It's a good race. It's well worth watching. Very, very entertaining. If you haven't seen it, sorry we spoiled it for you with knowing the winner, but believe me, it won't matter. You will still be on the edge of your seat watching that race. It's good stuff. And don't forget to get your tickets for the Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix next July 2008. You can go to laguna-seca.com, or if you want to do the full meal deal, go to usmotogpfans.com and check out Steve Jones's sweet deal that he's got going on there. It's a really good thing. And that's about going to do it. So thanks very much again, and I will talk to you guys next week. After a fairly long, but I think somewhat interesting show, I do feel that I have to tell you the usual disclaimer, which if you've listened to MotoGPOD before, you know it's pretty much the same thing every week, although I might try to spice it up by occasionally trying to be kind of funny or something like that. But the gist of it is that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL, and all other trademarks are the property of their respective owners and MotoGPOD. Should I leave that in? I don't know. We'll have a little internal debate, but MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of those other trademark owners.